This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. We're joined this segment by historian and author Tim McGrath. His focus this time around is James Monroe, the fifth United States president. Among the extraordinary group of early Americans who became known as the Founding Fathers, Monroe may be the least recognized, but with the remarkable range of his service to the nation, his extraordinary skill in shepherding the young nation through one of its most perilous periods, he and his achievements have found new resonance and relevance in this time. And Tim McGrath, good morning to you.
Well, good morning, Jim. Thanks for having us today.
Well, it's good to talk with you. James Monroe, fifth U.S. president. Before we get into the meat of what he did, and he did a whole lot in his time, one of the great ironies of our time, he's among the first five presidents. Three of them died on the 4th of July. And he died July 4, 1831. And for his time, he lived a long life, born in 1758. So he was, at that time, when you lived to be 73 years old, it was considered a full life. And what did he do in that time that you find so significant today that you feel like he has been neglected as one of the giants of his time?
Well, thanks, Jim. I appreciate it again being on and get to that question. I was just chuckling to myself when you mentioned about him dying on the 4th of July, 5 years after Adams and Jefferson died on the 4th of July in 1826. And I remember as a kid thinking about the two surviving presidents, ex-presidents at the time, John Quincy Adams and James Madison, and wondered what went through their heads every day on the 3rd of July. You know, is this it for me? You know, should we invite the family for dinner tonight? But regarding Monroe, he was my favorite president when I was seven. And when my editor, Brent Howard at Dutton and Penguin said, let's think big after we did a book on the Continental Navy, and talking presidents, I brought his name up. And while I was a history major and in college and thought pretty well read about people, I found out I didn't know enough about Monroe to hurt me. And the information was just staggering. A 50-year career of public service as a soldier, a diplomat, and a politician. He held more offices than any president before him or since. And the depth and breadth of the issues and events he was involved with, one of the experts in Virginia said he's sort of like a smart Forrest Gump, in that he seems to always be either there at the right time or the wrong time, but certainly taking a role in all of the events of the country, you know, from the Revolution up through the 1820s.
Tim McGrath is the guest, and he is the author of James Monroe: A Life. And for those not acquainted, Monroe served as U.S. president, U.S. Secretary of State, U.S. Secretary of War, U.S. Secretary of State on another occasion, Governor of Virginia, Virginia House of Delegates, U.S. Ambassador to the United Kingdom, U.S. Ambassador to France, U.S. Senator from Virginia, and a delegate to the Continental Congress. You are right. There is no American who has ever held as many positions, and you say he served all of them with distinction.
Yeah, I would think, too, to be honest with you, Jim, he also served, especially in the first third of his political career, as a very partisan politician. If he was alive today, he'd probably be on Fox News or MSNBC every day, depending on what the issue was. And it was interesting to see him literally morph as he moved into Madison's cabinet into, by the time he becomes president, adopting his old hero Washington's idea of building a consensus and trying to keep partisanship to a minimum. And he almost succeeds. He gets very close to eliminating that. And ironically, it's his own success being reelected and by all but one electoral vote that sort of undoes everything he's done. He makes it look too attractive for people to jump in on it. And the partisanship starts in his own cabinet, ironically.
U.S. President from 1817 to 1825 was James Monroe, and I mentioned he lived to be 73, and he was a young man in a hurry, graduated from the College of William and Mary, 1776 when he was 18. But he survived malaria, and in the Battle of Trenton in 1776, he was shot. How severely hurt was he?
That's a good question. He actually volunteers to be the lieutenant along with a relative of Washington's, William Washington, a captain from the 3rd Virginia, and they lead the advance force, about 40-some men, in the Trenton hours before Washington actually crosses the Delaware. And while they're en route in the waning hours of night, they pass a farmhouse and a host of dogs start barking, and an irate guy comes out yelling and everything else, and Monroe's trying to quiet him down. He's a doctor by the name of John Riker, and he believes it's the Hessians looking to pilfering his chickens. And Monroe starts talking to him, immediately realizes that they're Americans. And, oh, come in and get something, warm yourselves. We can't. And Riker elects to come along with Monroe. So when Monroe is shot, an artery severed up above his shoulder and collarbone, he would have bled to death except for the fact that Riker was there with his doctor's bag to put a clamp on things and get him off the streets and saved his life, or we'd never know who James Monroe was.
And he was 18 at the time, so he lived another 55 years. Tim McGrath is with us. His book, the premier opus about the fifth U.S. president, James Monroe, 877-217-5757, your number. Dan, downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Tim McGrath.
Yeah, Mr. McGrath, given the Missouri Compromise, slavery, the problems with the 1824 election, is the air of good feelings a justifiable nickname for Monroe's term in office?
That's a great question, and thanks for calling in, and the answer is no. But it stuck, and ironically, it came from a Federalist newspaper in Boston. It certainly could be accurate for the first 2 years of his presidency, but you're exactly right. There were other issues that came up that kind of undid that. The panic of 1819 is really our first Great Depression, and it particularly hit the American citizens in the Western and probably the northern southern part of the United States. And it really bothered him because he did not have FDR-like powers. He could not do a thing. The only thing he did was he did a tour through those states and made promises to the residents that he would do what he could to advocate the Congress make changes. And so that's one. You mentioned the Missouri Compromise, and again, officially, he's blocked out of this. This is an issue that has to be resolved in Congress. But again, Monroe reaches out and keeps the back door open for evenings. He reaches out to his son-in-law, George Hay, who's an accomplished Virginia politician, and his former secretary while he was in Europe, Nicholas Biddle, in Pennsylvania, to start working on gaining support for some kind of a consensus and basically the compromise of the Missouri Compromise. Mm-hmm. And his biggest resistance, ironically, comes from his own party in general and the Virginians in it in particular. And he finagles his way of, oh, I'm not really doing anything with this, but pushes to make sure that the compromise becomes a reality. But those certainly aren't part of an era of good feelings.
All right.
And you're exactly right. The 1824 election is just such a political, cauldron that it makes things, more or less difficult by the time he's out the door.
What was the origin of the Monroe Doctrine?
The doctrine really originates because Monroe and his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, are of like minds. Once he's elected president, there's a real support led by Speaker of the House Henry Clay to recognize the new young Republicans, the republics that are establishing themselves through battle in South America by Bolivar, Bernardo O'Higgins, and other leaders. And Monroe is not ready to do it yet. He's taking a let's wait and see approach, but he's also taking a worldview. He is looking at what's happening in post-Napoleonic Europe with the rise of Metternich's approach and the return of the divine right of kings.
As far as today and Monroe's relevance to what we're experiencing right now, he was a man who was amid many crises during his career. How do you think he would have handled the pandemic today, or is there any way to know?
There is a way to know, Jim, and thanks for asking. He was a senator in 1793 when the yellow fever, first major yellow fever epidemic, wiped out, you know, thousands of Philadelphians. And he's a governor of Virginia in 1800, and he has the first of a couple of incidents of yellow fever outbreak while he's governor, a very severe one in Norfolk. And this is in July of the year, and he literally closes Norfolk off to everything and puts out a, you know, an edict and everything else that, you know, everyone's to stay put. And at the same time, he stipulates that the government will take care of those Virginians or those sailors from outside the country that are laid low, will be taken care of at government expense. And he does not lift this ban until November, when the medical experts have come back and said, it's stopped, it's done. So I think he would have been someone who would have erred on the side of caution rather than on the side of economics.
The book is James Monroe, A Life, from Tim McGrath, two-time winner of the Commodore John Barry Book Award, noted historian, and he has done the definitive biography of James Monroe.